The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The following Hillary statement. As I juggle my family life and here, today I have to leave promptly. So I apologize for any of you who wanted to talk to me afterwards, but I should really get home quickly. And also, this coming Saturday, we have a day-long retreat with Bob Stahl, who's a wonderful Buddhist teacher. He was a Buddhist monk and is one of the leaders in Northern California for doing the mindfulness-based stress reduction work. And he has a great love for teaching practices connected to the body. And so he's going to do one this Saturday on the Four Elements meditation, which is very much a body-focused meditation practice. And I won't be here next Sunday, and in my stead will be Maria Stratman will come and give the talk. So, a few weeks ago, I gave a talk here on Sunday on the Buddha's teachings on dependent origination. Gave kind of an introduction to the topic about how the Buddha sees one of the primary insights that the Buddha discovered is the insight into how things arise dependently on other things. And it's a deep insight into this. It's a pretty common insight for many religious traditions to have insight into impermanence. And Buddhism emphasizes it quite a bit. But it's not simply the insight into impermanence which was the key emphasis of the Buddha, but rather was in seeing impermanence to see how the impermanent world arises and passes due to causes and conditions. So understand those causes and conditions. And the teachings of dependent origination are the teachings having to do with trying to emphasize or understand our experience from the point of view of these causes and conditions that make up this experience of our life, impermanent life. This is important because if it's simply emphasizing impermanence without understanding causes and conditions, it's very easy to end up with a formula that looks something like this. Impermanence equals suffering. And therefore, if you want to be free of suffering, you have to be free of impermanence. So you better just, check out somehow. The Buddha's insight is that it had a little different equation. It's perhaps it would be this way. It would be impermanence times clinging equals suffering. And with that kind of equation, if you see it that way, then if you take away the clinging, then the world of impermanence doesn't, in a multiplying kind of equation, the impermanence doesn't equal suffering. And so the Buddha's insight is you can do something about the world of suffering. You don't have to get rid of the impermanent world. What we're trying to do is to free ourselves of the clinging in relationship to it. And in that freedom from clinging, then comes liberation and freedom. This kind of points to this idea of dependent origination or dependent co-arising, different ways of saying this term. And it's so important that there's a statement made by the Buddha's disciple Sariputta that the person who sees dependent origination sees the Dharma. The one who sees the Dharma sees dependent origination. And so there's something about seeing the nature of dependent origination that it really is the heart of seeing what the Buddha's Dharma, the Buddha's teachings. It's considered to be a very profound topic, and it's also considered to be difficult to really understand. So I can't say that I understand it well. But I will try to make a presentation here, try to make it somewhat understandable for all of us. And it's going to be a little bit more like a class today because I have a handout. And I apologize to those people on the web who are going to be listening to this.
We can
post it, yes. So so the primary function of the teachings on dependent origination, as the Buddha taught it, is to understand the causes and conditions for our suffering and the causes and conditions for liberation from that suffering. Sometimes people have taken dependent origination, the teachings of it, to try to explain everything. And the Buddha was not trying to explain everything, the interconnected nature of reality, of life, and all that, but rather was, which is a big topic and maybe a worthwhile topic, but it seems that the Buddha's interests were relatively narrow. And that was his emphasis was to really hone in on suffering and freedom from suffering, bondage and liberation. To really hone in. So what are the causes and conditions for that world? And so a lot of it has to do then looking at suffering. And before I give you the handout, I wanted to read to you a piece of Naomi Shihab Nye's poem, Kindness. Some of you might have heard it. And I learned something interesting about this poem on Friday. That's why I wanted to read it. And also it relates to this. In this poem she writes, "Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing." She wrote this poem when she was traveling on a bus in Colombia. And she was held up by bandits, apparently. And everyone on the bus, everything was taken from them. Passports, money, luggage, clothing, everything was taken from them. And then the bus continued and they went into a village and they had nothing. They had not came to the village, nothing. And the villagers took them in and took care of them and helped them and supported them. And that act of kindness, that she wouldn't have experienced that act of kindness without that experience of the loss, of that suffering that happened there. For her, there was a conditional relationship between the two. Maybe she was going to the village anyway, but she wouldn't have experienced the degree of support and help and kindness. So here she talks about you must know the sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows. So the Buddha, I would think, did this. He listened to the sorrow, to suffering, to catch the threads of it. The many threads that, and in seeing, catching the threads, then he could unravel it. So, so one of the, his descriptions of those threads is something called the 12-fold chain of dependent origination. And this is the topic of today, the 12-fold chain of dependent origination. Try to make it a little bit more understandable for you, those of you who have encountered it before. And those of you who haven't, introduce you to this very important topic in the teachings of the Buddha. So with that, I'll hand out this handout. And if maybe someone could help me do it so it goes a little bit faster. Just here, you take some, and you could take some. Make sure to take some to the outer hall. So does everyone have one? Anybody not have any? So a few more kind of towards the back, if there are. Are there six more available? I have some more here. For class? So, at the, near the top, it has the provisional chain of dependent co-arising. Dependent co-arising is another way of saying, translating the term that's translated, so it's dependent origination. And provisional means that it's just kind of a way that I formulated it. To get us into the topic, to make it a little more understandable before we look at how it's actually formulated in the Buddhist version. So it begins with ignorance, which we talked about a little bit last week. It begins with being ignorant. And ignorance here does not refer to the absence of knowing something, not knowing, but rather has to do with ignoring some aspect of reality, some aspect of what's going on. So the act of ignoring, turning away, perhaps not understanding something which is really central to how we engage in the world, respond to the world, and relate to the world. And what we are ignoring and how we ignore things has a big impact on what we intend. So ignorance shapes intending. So if I think that if I'm ignorant about the tremendous role that suffering has in my life, then that ignorance will affect what my intentions and aspirations might be. So it might be that I'm unfamiliar with my suffering, but the suffering makes me very uncomfortable. And so I think that not understanding, really understanding that suffering, I'll try to fix that discomfort. And that trying to fix it in ways which are not really relevant to the suffering itself, is an example of intending. So our ignorance affects what we intend in our life, our aspirations, our motivations, our wishes, our desires, things that are very central to what human beings are about. So our ignorance has some shapes. What we do. Intending shapes attending, how we attend to things. So if you have an intention for something, then it's relatively common then for that to influence how we pay attention. So if my intention is to leave here as soon as I can at the end of the sitting, then my attention goes to, is the side door open? I'm kind of already kind of not taking the whole range of all the different things I can experience in this world right here now, and I'm looking towards a particular part of it, the doors. Where are those doors? So intention can affect how we attend to things, what we attend to, what we notice in our environment, what we pick up. So attending, the act of attending. Attending shapes how the body and mind is mobilized. So if I am intending, if I'm attending to doors, where there are open doors, I'm going to be mobilizing my eyes to see. If I'm wanting beautiful music, or if I'm wanting not having loud car music, that's really important for me as I sit here and meditate. I really don't want to have large, loud, backfiring cars driving down Hopkins and affecting my meditation. That's my intention. And unfortunately, that intention not to have loud car signs sounds affects my how I attend, because I'm a little bit alert then to listening to the sound of the cars. And because I'm alert to listening, what's mobilized is my ears, my hearing thing. That's mobilized, that's activated. So how we pay attention, the way in which we pay attention affects how our body and mind is mobilized. And both in our musculature, how we lean forward, how we pull back, and how we sit. You know, a lot of different things about our body are activated by how we pay attention. If I just suddenly told you that there was a mountain lion in the back room, many of you would just sit up straight. You'd be mobilized. And then how your body is mobilized shapes sensing. So that's kind of already covered. So you're mobilized. I say there's a mountain lion, and suddenly you're sitting up straight, and you're hyper alert to maybe the sound, to looking. You look for the doors. How do I get out of here? As the body and mind is mobilized, brings energy into or activates the sensing organs. Shapes how we sense things, how we pick things up. Sensing then shapes what we contact in the world, what sense contact is. My hearing is activated, and because it's activated, I'm much more prone to hear the sound of the cars going by. And every sound the car goes by becomes measured. Was that too loud? Was that okay? You know, and so that I make contact with the world outside. Some of you are sitting here and couldn't care less about the cars going by. And you had other things that you were concerned about. Perhaps you were concerned about, would your knees survive? And so your intention was really concerned with surviving through the sitting. And so you attended to what was most challenging for you, your knees. And so it mobilized your body and mind in a certain kind of way around the knees. And your senses, your tactile senses, you know, focused. And then you made contact with that little ache that's happened there. And that ache then loomed big in your mind. I've had equal degree of discomfort in my body. At times I was highly aroused around it and concerned and contracted around it. Other times it hardly registered. I kind of knew it was there. It wasn't really a concern of mine. What I was most concerned about was lunch. You know, and I was, you know, getting to lunch on time, or most concerned about this person I'm upset with, you know, and the thoughts and ideas. That's what's really going on. So I'm activated and mobilized then into my mind. And that's when make contact then with my thoughts. So how our senses, how we're sensing shapes how we connect to the world. Contact here can mean connect, how we connect, where the connection actually happens. The contacting shapes how we feel about it. Some people will say feeling about it is the very basic, raw, how we feel about it, like I like it and I don't like it. Okay, so once you make contact, you can have a relationship to it. It can be pleasant, it can be unpleasant, that experience. You can like it, you cannot like it. Or some more neutral kind of way of being with it. The feeling can shape what we crave, what we want to have happen. So I make contact with the sound outside. The car sound is quite loud. I don't like it. And that shapes what I further want. What I want is I want a quiet meditation center. Or I want IMC to issue out earplugs by the door when people come. And if there's any kind of oomph, we call it craving behind that wanting. The craving, once there's craving, that kind of craving, then that shapes can shape clinging. And the clinging takes the form of a lot of attachment. Kind of the mind is stuck, is driven by what it wants. And so you might find yourself going home and you just can't let go of the fact that IMC is located in a place where the street is busy. And so you're just really upset about this and you can't let go of it. So you're really kind of just obsessing about it. You know, how could these Buddhists do it? And that clinging then shapes something called becoming. And becoming is a rich word. One of the things it implies is identity, forming an identity around something. So it could be now we form an identity around someone who is a righteous protester. And you're going to write that letter to the president of IMC and CC it to Gil about the sounds outside and something really needs to be done, and earplugs is the solution. And I've now, you know, become this righteous protester. So becoming something. Once I become something, that gives birth to something else. That gives birth to further attachments or further habits. It gives birth to a kind of reified identity. And that reified identity gives birth to further suffering. Once we become something like that, or have a habit or a strong kind of identification around something we're clinging to, then as the world changes and flux and moves, then it challenges and threatens that reified identity, that thing we've become, given birth to. And so we suffer. So if, say, for example, that you become this righteous protester of loud car sounds, and you write a letter to me, and I say thank you for the letter and leave it at that, that might give birth to a new discomfort for you. You might suffer new suffering. Now I've been disrespected. Gail doesn't see me as this righteous, you know, protester of injustice in this world. And so now we can get worked up even more. Once we get worked up even more, and don't relate to that way of being worked up in wise ways, but relate to it through ignorance, through being ignorant about the true nature of it, that ignorance then affects again how we intend, what we attend to, and so it goes on. So this is often presented as a loop, a supporting loop that goes around and around. The most, at the very... So the Buddha formulated or came up with these threads, or these chains of suffering, to try to help us look at the nature of suffering and begin teasing it apart so we can start seeing the causes and conditions of it. The particular constellation of suffering that was very prominent, kind of in the forefront of his concern, was the suffering that is connected to identification, to identifying oneself, this is who I really truly am, or this is who I really truly am not, and then the kind of clinging and contraction around that idea of self, the idea that the self is something, and this is who I really am, true self kind of idea, or even provisional sense, anything we hold on to self, that's a place where many people suffer. Whether there is a self or is not a self, or it is a true identity or not true identity, is maybe secondary to the fact that there's a tremendous amount of suffering in this world around people's identification, around the self. So this whole approach of dependent origination is meant to address suffering, the genesis, the cause and conditions of it, but it's very rich to look at it and look at ourselves, look at our suffering, and look at how the suffering is connected to identity issues. And how you identify yourself, how you see yourself, how you want to represent yourself to others, how you want them to see you, how you hold on to all those things. So then We come to the next list here, the Buddhist chain of dependent co-arising. And so this is more the technical way it's presented in Buddhism. And we'll go backwards from the bottom up. So it starts with, from the bottom, aging and death. And then the list actually goes on in sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So we start with that. And then what are the causes and conditions for that? If there's no causes and conditions for our sorrow and despair, then we're just stuck with it until it decides on its own to go away. But if there are causes and conditions for it, it's possible to enter into them, trace them back to the source, be really present, understand what they are, and go backwards into them. And that backwards kind of entering into that world, it's possible to find a place where something can be liberated, be freed. So, if there's going to be, so this aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair is meant to, is sometimes presented in Buddhism in shorthand as suffering. So suffering has a condition. Suffering won't be there unless it has a particular condition. And the condition, as the Buddha calls it here, is birth. And exactly what it means, birth, here is different interpretations. We don't have to go into it here now. But if we lump together birth and becoming, the condition for suffering is the becoming or the birthing, the creation of an identity. So the story I've told sometimes is of when I was in college, I was introduced kind of to art. And I was happily doing a lot of drawing and painting. And then at some point I decided that now I was an artist. And I'd been happily doing art without being an artist. There was no problem. But then at some point I decided I was an artist. And the amazing thing is the day I decided I was an artist was the day I stopped doing art. Because then I was going to, then I had to do it for that sake of the identity, which didn't work. I couldn't do it for the sake of the identity. And now plenty of people do have an identity and they do things because of it. They're tied to it. But from my situation, I was limited by that identity. I was caught by it. And I was better off without the identity. I would have continued doing art the way that I held on to it. There's something about the nature of suffering that is tied, oftentimes, to identity. It's becoming something or not wanting to become something. I'm not one of those people. And so then resistance comes up, fear comes up. Then becoming, we don't become an identity. Or say it this way, it's very important to say it accurately. The kind of becoming or identity that leads to suffering. The kind of identity that leads to suffering has a cause or a condition for its arising. And that condition is clinging. So we cling onto it. Clinging means we grasp onto something. We're not going to let it go. We're driven. There's obsession. There's a sense of stuckness. We can't just kind of shed. Oh, you know, desires are a dime a dozen. Okay, I want something. I'll just let it go and go on to the next thing. It's like we can't put it down. We're kind of driven by it or obsessed by it. And so the kind of, so suffering, in order for suffering to be there, there has to be the condition that, the necessary condition for suffering is clinging. The necessary condition for clinging is craving. So craving is something that's easier to drop, but we haven't grasped yet, but it's a very strong wanting. The necessary condition for craving is feeling. The necessary condition for feeling is to have contact with something, to connect to something. The necessary condition for feeling, for connection, contact, are the six senses. you're not going to connect unless you have the senses operating. So we're talking about real connection in the present moment. You're not going to have connection unless there's what's called in Buddhism nama rupa, mentality and physicality. The mind and body, which in the upper list I call it how the mind-body is mobilized. Because mind-body, mentality and physicality in Buddhism is not the mind and body in the abstract, the solid, you know, flesh and bone and stuff like that. That's not the body we're talking about. We're talking about the sentient body. Buddhism is always the body that can be experienced is different from the body that can be thought about or imagined. So the felt body and the felt mind. So physicality and mentality and physicality here, the namarupa refers to the way that we experience our mind and body, not how we think it is in the abstract. So, and then how we experience our body is very closely connected to how we attend, how we pay attention to things. And here in Buddhism it's called vijnana, is the Pali word, often translated into English as consciousness, which leads to no end of confusion, to call it that. And it's probably better, maybe simpler to call it cognition, the simple act of cognizing, being aware in some very simple way. But why it's confusing is that consciousness, for many people, seems very innocent. Our consciousness is just kind of like, you know, this blank screen that records things just the way they are. But Buddhism doesn't posit this blank, pure screen of awareness that just records things as they are. Awareness is always mediated through some degree of conceptualization of concepts and ideas. And so so cognition is probably a better translation for vijnana. And so how we cognize affects what our experience is of our body and mind. Our experience of the body and mind affects how the six senses are activated, and so forth it goes. And then our cognition, so again, we're talking about that cognition that's going to lead eventually to suffering. That cognition, not all kinds of cognition, but that cognition that's going to eventually lead to suffering, that has a condition. And that condition is called formations, sankhara, or fabrications, mental formations. The primary one of mental formations is intending, intention. It's our dispositions, our thoughts, our inner kind of mental life in relationship to anything. And so, and the primary disposition, primary inner mental faculty that has to do with here is intending, our intentions. And the kind of intentions or the kind of mental dispositions that we have that's going to lead to suffering, it itself has a condition. And that condition is ignorance. And so if we're ignorant, then that shapes how our dispositions are going to be. Our disposition is going to shape and down the line. So if we understand this as being an attempt to tease apart the causes and conditions of suffering, then we always have to understand that what's being talked about here are particular subsets of formations, consciousness, mind, body, senses, contact, feeling, those there. It's not describing all of it, every possible kind that you can have, but it's describing that comes into play in a chain of cause and effect that's going to lead to suffering. It's often said it's not a causal chain, it's a conditional chain, meaning that one doesn't cause the next, but the first one is the condition for the next one. So ignorance is a condition for the kind of mental formations that's going to lead to suffering. So this is kind of complicated. That's why we have a handout, and you know, why I call this a class today. But what it means is that when we suffer, it's possible to begin questioning what is operating in that suffering. What's going on there? Can we start, and as Naomi Chiab Nai said, you know, to start seeing the threads or the fabric of what this is, to listen to its voice of our suffering. So what is, how are these conditions operating when we are suffering? Is there an identity that has come into being that we're operating from? Can we look and question that? Is there something we're clinging to? Is there something we really want that somehow lays as a condition for how we're suffering? Is there some intention, some disposition that we have? You know, what's going on here? And primarily, are we ignorant? In what way might ignorance be operating here as I suffer? And I think, as I said last week, I hope I said it, one of the primary forms of ignorance that is a condition for this chain is ignorance about our suffering. So ignorance about the Four Noble Truths. So if we feel uncomfortable, if we suffer, and we don't understand the nature of that suffering, or if we react to it in unconscious ways, that perpetuates the chain. But if we use wisdom to turn and look at the suffering, then we can break that the chain. So if I'm suffering, one of the ways to break the chain is to stop and bring attention to the suffering. So we look at the suffering in a non-reactive way. When we look at suffering in a non-reactive way, then that suffering, it's much harder for that suffering to operate as a condition for our mental dispositions, formations to operate, our intentions to operate. And once our intentions in relation to suffering are not operating, then the rest of the chain doesn't come into play. So if I come to IMC and I'm kind of really upset about something difficult in my life, it's really important for me to get a moment of silence because I feel so uncomfortable. I came here to escape from my suffering, and it's really important to have some silence. And it better not have those cars. And so I'm kind of reacting to my discomfort. I'm looking for some relief from it, which is maybe okay, but I'm clinging perhaps to that relief. And so there's a whole chain of conditions then that leads me to want to make sure there's no loud sounds to disturb my refuge here. That would be a rising out of ignorance. To not be ignorant would be to recognize, here's my suffering. Let me turn towards it. Be present. I'm upset about something in my life. Let me not try to escape from it. Let me try to be present for it in a non-reactive way. And that non-reactive presence, being present, upright, not being for or against it, and just being for it, is one of the ways of starting to break the chain or the cycles, the loops that happen around these things. Once we learn to stay present for it, then that becomes a condition for other things to happen. One thing that happens is it gives a condition for deeper seeing. And perhaps we can begin to see more deeply what these causes and conditions are. And we can see other aspects of the chain that we can have some relationship to. Oh, look at that, I'm clinging to something. So the reason I'm so distressed when I came to IMC this morning, I wasn't clinging to my suffering, or I wasn't clinging to wanting peace, or I was clinging to wanting some peace and quiet. But really what it is, I was clinging to the hurt that I had when my boss got angry with me. I'm clinging to that hurt. Oh, I didn't realize I'm still holding on to that, even though it happened 30 years ago. And so by the non-reactive presence breaks the chain to some degree and allows us hopefully begin to look more deeply at some of these other elements that are going on. So then we come to the bottom of the list, the liberative dependent co-arising. So the normal chain of dependent co-arising is meant to describe the conditions for suffering. The Buddha also had teachings about describing the conditions for liberation from that suffering, liberation. And appropriately enough, that this list begins with suffering. You're not going to become free of suffering unless you suffer. That's a condition for it. And otherwise, it's not relevant. And so then if you relate to the suffering in a wise way, if you have understanding there's a practice, there's a path to follow, there is something you can do about it, then hopefully it gives birth to some confidence, or here the word is translated as faith, but it could be confidence. So the suffering gives birth to, is a condition for confidence to be there, for being able to address it. And having confidence to address it is really important, so you don't feel like you're a victim of your suffering. And then hopefully, and this is a little bit idealistic perhaps, but hopefully that confidence gives birth to a little bit of gladness, rapture, calmness, happiness, and concentration. These first seven items in the list are meant to be causes and conditions that lead to the mind becoming stable. A stabilizing of our inner life. So, if because once the if we can stabilize the inner life, stabilize the mind, get it calm and concentrated enough, then it's possible to start seeing more deeply. It's very hard to see deeply into our the chain of dependent origination. It's very hard to see deeply into the nature of our clinging, our nature of our identification. I don't want to underestimate that how difficult it is. Because I'm sure many of you have had been kind of stumped sometimes. You know, why am I suffering? This doesn't make any sense. You know, what's going on here? You know, I look at it and look at it and look at it, and it just doesn't reveal itself to me. What's going on? But so in Buddha, one of the functions of meditation practice and Buddhist practice as a whole is to help provide the steps 2 to 7. Hopefully Buddhism is not providing the first one. You're suffering. You come with that. But hopefully the Buddhist practice can support you in providing the confidence, what's called gladness, rapture, calmness, happiness, and concentration. And once the mind is stabilized from that, then comes knowledge and vision, knowledge and insight. Then comes ability to see deeply into our experience. So here the idea is to really see deeply into our experience. There are causes and conditions that make that possible. And those are the preceding ones. Once we see deeply into our experience, then it's harder to be tricked by our experience. So as long as I think that if I can have a silent street with no cars, that's my happiness is dependent on that, I'm going to be tricked by every loud car that comes by, tricked into reacting. But if I see, oh, my happiness is not dependent on the car's sounds, really, I can see how I was clinging to various variety of things. And it's really the genesis of my suffering had to do with my clinging. Then when the loud car goes by, I'm no longer going to be tricked by it. I'm no longer going to be in the spell of that. I'm no longer going to be reacting strongly to that. And this idea of not being tricked by it or not being enamored with it or enamored in a negative way or not being obsessed by it or not being in the spell of it is called in Buddhism disenchantment. We get disenchanted. I've gotten disenchanted with that car sound. I was so enchanted before in a negative way. Right? You understand? So once we start having insight, knowledge and understanding, then a natural outcome of that, or a next step of that, is we no longer are in the spell of all the things in the world that we tie ourselves to, that we connect our happiness and suffering to. And that we kind of begin to relax. It's a beautiful process of relaxing the grip of things in the world being kind of the condition for my suffering and happiness. And then as disenchantment happens, then with dispassion happens. So I'm no longer tricked by the cards of the sound, I'm no longer obsessed by the sounds of the, no longer think the sounds of the car are really the source of my suffering. And therefore I begin to relax. I relax the concern for the car sound. And that relaxation in this language here is called dispassion. The drive, the lust, the obsession. So the first disenchantment has to do with understanding something about the objects. And dispassion has to do with understanding something about your affect. You begin to relax and soften and not be driven so much. And once we relax enough and soften this drive and this enough, our clinging enough, then at some point the mind lets go of itself. For consciousness no longer clings to consciousness. And when consciousness no longer clings to itself, then liberation happens. The mind gets set free. And in Buddhism, liberation is not good enough. And there's a 12th step, which is knowledge of liberation. And it's a very important part of this path, because a person, when they have some degree of liberation, they're supposed to turn around and reflect or understand what it is that they've been liberated from. And what do we still need to be liberated from as well? So what have we been freed from, and where we're still stuck? So for example, you might be liberated from attachment to self, identity. It's one of the core things to be freed of in Buddhism. But there might still be attachment to anger. Anger is a much deeper seated function of the mind than identification. So the person realizes, oh, that's the experience of liberation really showed me something very profound about the nature of identity and how identity works in my mind, and how beautiful it is, how safe it is not to be wrapped up in identity. I see that. That's the knowledge part, knowledge of liberation. And I also see that I still have an issue around anger. I still get caught up in things. So I think there's more work to be done. So we don't want to rest on our laurels. We want to kind of do this reflection. What is still left to be done? And then the process can continue. So I hope that made some sense to you. I'm sure some of you have encountered this before, because many books in Buddhism, hopefully this makes it a little more sensible, more accessible to you. And if it's still mystifying to you or confusing, then one option you have is to leave your confusion here. And maybe some point later it'll become clear at the right time for you. So thank you very much.